Welcome to the Dust Off Medic podcast. The views expressed here are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else.
We're going to take care of you, right?
Welcome back to the Dust Off Medic podcast. Max here today. Training is a centerpiece mission of the Army. According to FM7, we conduct, quote, challenging, relevant, and realistic training performed to the highest standards. And going back to the mid-2000s, the guiding document for these training standards has been Training Circular 8-800, Medical Education and Demonstration of Individual Competence, which ends up spelling the word medic. We simply call it TC 8-800. Recently, this central document got a major overhaul, and today we have a couple of the authors with us. Welcome to the Dust Off Medic podcast, Caleb and Hunter. Why don't we start off with Caleb? Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do for the Army and some of your background?
Hey, yeah, Matt, say thanks for having us here. I want to make sure that Hunter gets the credit as the author. You know, I did very, very little for this thing, so he's definitely the brains behind the operation. As far as myself, I joined the Army in 2002. I'm currently a Master Sergeant E8 in the Army. I had the privilege of growing up in 3rd Ranger Bat, which I'm obligated to say is the best of the three Ranger battalions at Fort Benning, Georgia. I am a Whiskey 1 Special Operations Medic. I graduated the schoolhouse at JSONC TC, Fort Bragg. So I spent several years at 3rd Ranger Bat. From there, I went up to Fort Bragg, worked at the MAU for many years. And then after that, I had a stint at Madigan Army Medical Center, Joint Base Lewis-McChord. From there, spent 2 years as the First Corps Senior Medic. And now I currently serve as the NCIC for the newly established Directorate of Simulation in Joint Base San Antonio under the Medical Center of Excellence. And I am dual-hatted also as the NCIC for Combat Medic Sustainment Division. So in a nutshell, that's how do we figure out how to sustain our 34,068 whiskeys across all compos? And then for simulation, what is the aggregate medical simulation requirement for all operational medical AOCs and MOSs, which you think is something the Army would have figured out, you know, a couple of decades ago, but here it is 2022 and we're trying to get after it.
That's awesome. You know, and in a bit of digging and studying, I found out that the combat medic didn't really exist until the middle of World War II, as we know it today. And so there's a lot that we are doing in the medical community. And really over the last, you know, I was in for 16 years and seeing just the generational change that our generation of medics is bringing about nowadays. It's really phenomenal to see just the quality of medicine increasing. So, and it sounds like you have a lot on your plate.
Yeah, you stay busy, man. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, think back to the last time you had an endocrinology course, right? There's levels of complexity, right? And the challenge is if you come into it ignorant, you can cause second and third order effects that create more damage. So there's a lot of behind the scenes work. And this is really, you know, as a ranger, a lot of times I'm tempted to solve problems with a hatchet, with brute force. But I've learned a lot from Hunter, you know, with the civil affairs mindset of buy with and through rather than, you know, challenge directly. And that's a lot of what Hunter's accomplished with TC 8-800. There's some subtlety to this document in terms of how we set up to orient towards evidence-based medicine, clinical practice guidelines. There's a lot of knee-jerk kind of parochialism or reactionism in the services when you start bringing up things like joint. It kind of immediately triggers a negative response that, you know, hey, Army first, DHA isn't our real dad. You know, that kind of stuff. But there's a lot of good evidence-based medicine that obviously is coming out of JTS, you know, triggered on the trauma registry, good pathways there that we've observed in the special operations community. So a lot of what Hunter has achieved within the TC 8-800 is very subtly orienting our training methodology towards evidence-based medicine as it develops.
All right. And Hunter, so it sounds like he's passed the ball off to you with the buy with and through. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came up in the Army and what you do for the organization.
So I joined back in 2007 as a combat medic, spent time in an engineer unit right off the bat, and then moved on, went to SOCOM and Special Operations Combat Medic, and then served in Ranger Training Brigade as a combat dive medical technician for a couple of years, and then went to Civil Affairs, and then followed on PSYOP, and then eventually went down to the Medical Center of Excellence and actually filled the role as NCIC at the DOS and Combat Medic Sustainment Division, and then moved on to be the 68 Whiskey Enlisted Subject Matter Expert and Senior Training Developer for Combat Medic at the Med COE. And I'm currently serving as the Senior Enlisted Advisor to U.S. Army Medical Material Development Activity at Fort Detrick. So kind of stepped out of that operational realm into the developmental realm of the Army and the joint side, also working with those guys. And it's really an eye-opening experience. And I think that's something that, you know, a lot of people across, a lot of NCOs and soldiers across the Army don't see, is what happens on the backside in that developmental realm. And how do we get to these, not only the training, but how do you get fielded these devices? How do you get these new capabilities out there? It's quite a process. And, you know, and hopefully it will shine a little light on how that happens in the training domain and how we got to this TC-800 that we have today.
Yeah. And it's interesting how much of what we consume in the Army as the end users in terms of doctrine and materials and the training we get, we don't see the development that takes place behind the scenes, and we don't really understand the high level decision making that led to those decisions. And, you know, Caleb talks about second and third order effects of decision making. I mean, that's your daily life when it comes to the development side of the house, right?
It is. It's in it. And like he said, it can, sometimes there's quick decisions and stuff that have to be made, and these, they can have impacts for years. So it's pretty stressful, to be honest with you, but we try to get through it. It's a lot of moving pieces that have to happen.
Mm-hmm. Now, and talking about like downstream impacts of decisions having effects for years, the last version of TC-800 was published back in 2014. And the document, it's about 120 pages long. And it had quite a bit of information and guidance on the training and sustainment of medics. And then it went into a significant amount of information on validation testing and things like that, what medics in the Army now call their table eights. Although it bears repeating that tables 1 through 7 are training tables and table 8 is simply a validation table. But colloquially, it all sort of gets smashed down together into table 8 training, which is a misnomer. Now, what do you think the downstream impact was of that 2014 rewrite of TC-800?
I think it kept us in that mindset of that, like you said, that it gets treated as a course, as if it were like a institutional course. When the reality is it's really a training strategy, like Caleb was saying earlier. And it kept that mindset going across the Army for our medics, and then for the NCOs, that it's a course. I got to send my, and we started to lose the idea that the NCOs should be running training. They should be training their soldiers, and not chunk training. It really was meant to be spread out over time, but it's just become this thought process that it is an institutional course when it's not. So that was one of the effects that it had, and we started looking at the medical simulation training centers and different sites across the Army, the hospitals, MTFs, then they start running these courses. And it really took away from like what Army training should be. So that was one of the things we wanted to try to address with this rewrite.
Yeah, if I can just kind of make a crappy analogy, which is a lot of what we saw, like Hunter said, with the 2014 TC-800, the analogy is like the ACFT. I don't know if you've had a chance to do that yet, Max.
I'm an APFT generation guy.
Yeah, okay, all right. Well, if you get a chance, go out there. But if the Table 8 is our ACFT test for record or APFT test for record. Imagine if you only did PT for a week before that test. And that's kind of the mindset that we had with the TC is that, oh, that is our sustainment. That's also our training. And then we validate. So if you go out there and look at the a difficulty level of the validation, you know, what are we getting out of our table 8 validation? If you imagine that being a dial with, you know, 11 means, hey, you can save a life, and one means, okay, you're able to dress yourself appropriately. You know, what's the difficulty of our table 8 set at right now? And if we're honest with ourselves, which is painful sometimes, but I think important, you know, we're probably set about a 3, right? Which is what you would expect if you only have a week of training. So back to my crappy analogy, you know, what we're getting out of this is a week of PT and then you take your validation. It doesn't matter really how good that week is. We can only get folks so far, and there's limitations in time, you know, and we've got to get into evidence-based education theory and all that kind of stuff, right? How much can we cram into a soldier's brain? What can they do with psychomotor under escalating stress? And then what can we validate? Mm-hmm. You know, how many people are we failing in our test? What's the sweet spot for that? I think last time I checked, everybody passes, right? To me, that's an indicator that the difficulty, again, is not set at a very high level. Now, if you're doing PT all day, every day, 365, well, you can probably ramp up. You should expect to see better results on an ACFT, right? Mm-hmm. There's a sweet spot there. So that's really what we're getting, is that across the force, especially in the minds of our non-medical commanders and their sergeants major, you know, what do they need to do cynically to make the spreadsheet green? Well, it's get them to tables and they validate. Okay, so that's what we get. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like what you're describing is the checkbox mentality that we all hate, but sort of unknowingly or unwittingly sort of participate in, because it's so baked into the system in a lot of ways, where we have certain metrics that we have to meet. We have to make those spreadsheet boxes green. I guess that brings us into the rewrite. So this rewrite, you went from 120 pages in the previous version down to 30 pages in this new version. So when you talk about, you know, stripping something down to brass tacks to really boil it down to its simple, most fundamental elements, it sounds like, and it looks like that's exactly what you've done here. Can you describe sort of the process that led you to putting this document on the Army Weight Control Program a little bit here?
So a lot of the thought process, it's funny because two things happened there. Was one, the way it was written in the past with certain skills being outlined and all the scenarios being in there, it didn't allow for room to maneuver training, to adapt training. So by removing those, it allows us to adjust the training to catch up to the current guidelines and stuff quickly. Instead of having to rewrite an entire training circular, now you can go to the landing page on MedCOE Combat Medic Sustainment website and get the link to that training there. And then that training is easier to update in that manner instead of rewriting this thing, because it took a little while because of the back and forth. So there was that thought process. And then is to streamline it and make it easier to change the training itself that supports the strategy. And then removing the skills, because the ICTL, the individual critical task list, have really come on board. Like enlisted MOSs have had those for quite some time now. Now your officer or officer counterparts have them. And we've been directed that those ICTLs will be trained from the Surgeon General. So that becomes your skills sheet. That is where your training work comes from, is meeting all those skill level appropriate tasks for a combat medic. So by linking to that, we're able to update continuously using some of the approaches, like using the ADDIE process to update training and stuff. So we're able to fix it in a website instead of rewriting this book every time.
And that's a huge improvement. One of the things that we hear a lot from medics, you know, on social media and other places that we engage, is that it seems like the Army pretty consistently lags behind the current evidence base supporting battlefield medicine, where we have folks like, you know, Dr. Steve Schauer was on here. We have, you know, other researchers that we've had on the show who are out there collecting the data so that we can make the best decisions possible. And these data are often codified in clinical practice guidelines, which are a little bit behind the curve. And we have the TCCC guidelines, which are now updated every year. So already there's a lag between when we're learning and when we're putting it into writing. And then for a long time, there's been a delay of years, sometimes even a decade behind when we first learn a lesson and when we implement it into doctrine. And it seems like this rewrite closes that gap and creates a system where that gap will remain closed, where it tightens not the kill chain. I heard this from Paul Luce. He was saying the life chain or the save chain, got to shorten the save chain.
yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, and that goes back to, you know, there's a lot of folks that talk about the Walker dip, you know, pre conflict or between conflicts, you have that, you know, essentially flushing of our skill set. But I would caution that, you know, there's that apocryphal saying by a Russian analyst saying, you know, the worst thing about fighting the Americans is they don't read their own doctrine, right? So even with the old TC, you know, how many NCOs actually out there read it? And now that our ICTLs are updated almost monthly on the Central Army Registry, how many folks are reading those? You know, it's as we kind of circulate around, most people don't. So that's changing the document is a great and necessary step. And again, really excited about the work Hunter's accomplished. But where have we changed how we train our trainers? You know, what is the validation loop between outcomes? So for, again, another crappy analogy, if I'm teaching somebody to shoot, I find it's really helpful if I have paper at the end of the range and I want to see where they group, how tight that group is, and how far away that is from the bullseye. And then if I'm teaching them to shoot better, well, I would expect, my working hypothesis would be that they would group tighter and that group would move towards the bullseye. If those things happen, then I know that training occurred. Otherwise, you know, if there's no change in the effect of the learner, I didn't do training, I wasted taxpayer dollars. So for our training methodology, how are our medics grouping right now, right? How are they scoring on live patients? Or how are they scoring on simulated patients? If our hypothesis is correct, if we're doing better medicine with better methodology, we should expect to see a change in how we're doing in the pre-hospital space. However, that requires us to have paper at the end of the range. In this case, data. We don't really have any data in the pre-hospital space. We don't really know how we're doing and no one's accountable for it. You know, if you dial into those Thursday morning JTS conference calls, 99% of the time, what do we hear? Well, something happened at point of injury. We don't really have any documentation. We can't find those guys, but we do have good documentation from evac all the way back through to return to duty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm very familiar with the JTS Combat Casualty Care Conference. That's every Thursday, and I think we've plugged it in the past here because we interviewed folks like, you know, Jen Gurney and other sort of people behind the scenes driving those sorts of conferences. But what you describe is spot on. You know, never do we hear from Role One. Rarely do we hear from the point of injury medevac, and it's only upon arrival at a facility with physicians, nurses, physicians assistants, where we start to see a documentation chain occur. And so moving from that, what sort of data collection is in place with this new TC? How are we documenting training and submitting those documents to some sort of central registry?
Yeah, I can jump on that and Hunter can correct me. But right now, the methodology is still not where we want it. So this is an incremental step to change our sustainment methodology from an hours-based methodology. We're really what we're doing, honestly, right now is just recording that a medic sat in the seat for 72 hours and something happened. And then they had that, you know, difficulty 3-level validation, which everybody passes for the most part. Okay, that's cool. That's where we're at, right? That's our bracketing round. But where we want to get to is away from hours towards competency. And conceptually, you know, it's easy to say, like, okay, yeah, let's validate competency, but we have a lot of obstacles there, and again, complexity to deal with to change that globally across the institution to a competency-based assessment model. As far as documentation right now, really what we get is paperwork verification that students showed up, they checked in, they checked out, paperwork is squared away, and they pass through stuff. And again, that's like, you know, back to my crappy range analogy. Hey, they went to the range, don't know how they grouped or what they scored, but they were there. And that's kind of where we're at.
Oh. Yeah. All ammo expended.
Yeah.
and so the document that you're talking about is the 7442, the DA form 7442.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, are you guys tracking anything about the after action report submission run by the JTS?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. In fact, I want to give credit, shout out to a fellow Ranger medic, now has gone to the dark side. That's Captain John Matha, who's a PA down here at the Medco. He just ran an experiment using the after action form as a grade sheet for a simulated trauma lane and submitted that to the trauma training registry under the JTS website. So we're very excited about that because that addresses that data capture piece. If we're getting universal, useful data aggregation, and we start building that architecture into our testing, ideally, every trauma lane that a medic runs, or medical lane, because we really got to start thinking about all hazards, you know, limited primary care, DMBI as well. If that's in a database, then we should, over time, be able to start correlating simulated patient performance to real-world patient outcomes. Right now in the pre-hospital space, we don't have anything that says success on a simulated patient is predictive of success on a real patient. We got opinion, but we all know what body part that's most like and why, right? And we got some salty medics that think we're doing good stuff, but hey, let's go ahead and put some paper at the end of the range and see how we're really scoring, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's another thing. So this TCO actually have to go into another view, right? When that comes on board, it's kind of tough to address these things. So we've noticed on our end during all the analysis for the enhanced 68 whiskey work that was done starting a couple years ago. And then I worked on it for the past 2.5 years is, you know, with the rewrite to AIT and the way we sustain. So we are moving. We wanted to address the cognitive degradation that happens when the combat medics leave. We know that there's a psychomotor degradation, but nobody ever addressed the cognitive side of it. So we contracted out the development of a virtual sustainment learning platform that's going to contain 200 hours of adaptive learning. And that's done in a simulation on a computer. And those count towards CEs, and it helps with the cognitive side, and then reinforces processes to the psychomotor domain when they get hands-on training out there. So it reinforces that. And then the next part is, how do we capture the data from the psychomotor? Like, how do we, if they're doing a certain skill, like initiate, well, it's not initiate an IV anymore, but within that, you know, given an IV, how do we know what steps are commonly missed, or how do we even get information out of that task to say, well, maybe the step's really not needed. And that's been a tough one to crack, but we're trying to set ourselves up with this to move with this TC rewrite to move towards that in the future. There's a lot of people working on it, not just for 68 whiskey, but it's being looked at for all medical. Hopefully in the future we'll have a solution. We found one for the cognitive domain, but not for the psychomotor yet.
Yeah. So if we can kind of put that into a use case or a vignette, right? There've been numerous papers over the last couple of years that would say what the average failure rate for crikes in combat is at 1/3, right? You know, I think that the original one was done, 2012? And I think that was redone again a couple of years ago when we found no change. So ideally, what we'd expect for a skill set, you know, low frequency but high risk, like the cricothyrotomy, once we find how we're grouping, right, you know, back to my range analogy, okay, well, that's kind of a crappy group, right? 1/3 failure. I mean, if that happened inside an MPF, my assumption is that people would be fired and there'd be a little bit of a retraining. You know, JCO may not be super happy about that. But in the pre-hospital environment where no one's accountable for outcome change, yeah, you know, inshallah, right? That's as good as it gets. So what we would expect is that feedback loop to say, okay, 1/3, hey, I'm not happy with that. Taxpayers shouldn't be happy with that. Let's tighten the group up. So what can we change? What's our variable? Is it the equipment? Is it the frequency of training? Is it the realism of training? Is it the simulation modality? You know, what variables can we change to affect that rate, and how do we know it's working? And again, that methodology doesn't currently exist. And we don't have medical officers accountable for that in the pre-hospital space.
It sounds like you guys have spent a lot of time thinking about this problem and quantifying it, that there are some systems in place and that things are getting better as we move forward. So what can the NCO do? What can that E5, E6 medic who's in charge of training, what can they do to help support moving this ball down the field?
No, that's a great question, right? Like, we've done all this work. Now, what does it mean for the end user? Like, why should they care? I think the short term is especially for our mid-grade NCOs, is arming themselves to engage their senior medics and their medical officers to move the ball forward. You know, not just asking for permission, but humbly taking disciplined initiative. I think we have something called Mission Command, or we used to get after evidence-based medicine and evidence-based instructional methodology. And this dovetails with another of Hunter's initiatives, which is the Medic Master Trainer. So it's not enough just to have the information, but how do we train it? How do it's working? And more importantly, and this is the non-sexy stuff, but how do you build your training plan 12 or 18 months out? How do you communicate your training plan effectively to your medical leader, but more importantly, your non-medical commander? How are our NCOs standing up in those training meetings to dovetail their training plans into the overall training plan for that unit? Understanding that time is our most precious resource, right? That takes a lot of work and a lot of effort. Ideally, that works well if you have a senior medic that teaches you how to do that. And unfortunately, and this is, please forgive me, I'm not trying to disrespect, but because we've had the drop the kids off at the pool kind of mentality of just drop them off at tables 8 and they come back trained, unfortunately, we have performed a disservice, I believe, to many of our senior NCOs, where they have not learned how to do those tasks effectively. So in the short term, it's, hey, guys, you know, grab yourselves by your bootstraps, jump high, try to pull yourself up higher. We'll give you supporting fire as best we can. But unfortunately, we're looking at a generational change of how do we engage simultaneously at all levels of medic, so that they're assisting each other in figuring this out and fighting for that training time and being able to articulate how it supports the larger collective mission for their unit. So that was a whole lot of words to say. It's not going to be easy, guys. It's not going to get fed to you. What we're asking for you to do is do more work, largely unappreciated, and get after it. But, you know, no pressure, man. You just got to figure it out before we start zipping up body bags. So, right.
That was a lot to unpack. You know, medics arming themselves to engage leadership, that seems to be a problem across the board, you know, especially with low density MOSs, where we really do have to, in your words, articulate what we do to our commanders and help them understand our value in their fight. And so the three points that you went over are, we need to arm ourselves with the best available evidence supporting our medicine. So, you know, keeping up with the TCCC guidelines and the stuff being put out by Department of Combat Medic Education. And then the second point that you hit on there was instructional methodology and then being able to plan your training effectively. So digging into instructional methodology, it's been said for a long time that the E5 sergeant is the primary trainer of the Army. Now you look at the most recent FM 7-0, and the commander is actually the primary trainer. They are ultimately accountable and responsible for the training that goes on in the Army. But when you look at the person training their team to be successful, you know, that is that E5, E6, mid-level NCO. What resources do they have available to them? Rank and file, mid-level NCO, what resources do they have available to improve their instruction capability? Is there anything specifically for medics? Is there primary instructor development courses available? What do you think?
So currently in the operational realm, so when we look at training, there's institutional training, which is what happened, like when medics go to AIT, AL, Advanced Leaders Course, Senior Leaders Course, those are institutional training courses. So of course, if you work in a place like that or in hospital education and training, you normally get to go to Army Instructor Course. They've changed the name of it over the years, but it's essentially just a basic Army instructor. You don't really have anything like that out there in the operational domain. And so what we looked at was, so for the combat medic and medical in general, was how do we model ourselves after our artillery and our infantry brothers and the tables? So, you know, they use gunnery tables. We use medic tables. They have master gunners, right? So that's the reason we're moving towards this medic master trainer concept. In the future, that course will be available and they'll receive training on like training methodologies, unit training management, getting deeper into doctrine and policy and being able to properly advise the commander. Right now, it's there's nothing really out there in the operational domain, but in the future there will be. I definitely say, you know, for NCOs, go read like 7-0 training, reading up on that. And then there's some things online you can go look up on training, but 7-0 will help drive it. Reading the TC, hopefully with the train the trainer courses coming on deployed medicine, those will hopefully get better over time to help push it. So
with that, one of the other primary lifts, if I can, is trying to revamp accessibility of information. So, you know, paying attention to things like prolongfieldcare.org, right? That is a great example, you know, from the leadership of those folks, of a organically developed and designed information sharing and development platform where subject matter expertise comes together, disseminates best practices, communicates effectively. And it's very tricky to grow a communication platform like that successfully. So again, kudos and hats off to everybody that's involved with that. But let's look at MilSuite, for example. Can you think of any thriving MilSuite community where there's, you know, regular information exchange? So that's part of the issue that we have is acknowledge, you know, I'm not quite a boomer, but I am dangerously obsolete when it comes to communication in the digital space. And, you know, as a nerd and introvert, that's not my forte. So a lot of the issue we have, and again, this is why we appreciate folks like yourself, is sharing information, encouraging collaboration, and feeding those communities. So we are, I say all that to say that we are working to revamp our digital presence. You know, anybody that's been on the Combat Medic Sustainment Division website, I would say probably in the last 4 years, will notice that it's been out of date, broken links, et cetera. So that's a lot of the process is getting that spun up, reblued, and then using those, like Hunter was saying earlier, with Doctrine as a landing page that can be kept up to date with the best and the brightest. And OSHA encourages that information sharing because, full disclosure, like, we got a training strategy out there. Okay, that's great. We got some evidence-based medicine, but How does that apply to the Arctic environment? How does that apply to mountains? How does that apply to armor, light infantry, or the medium force, or the aviation force? How does this work in maritime environments? You know, we do not have the lift here at the Center of Excellence to develop the training support packages and the environmental variants in the pre-hospital space. But hey, we got schools for all those things, right? How can we incentivize, enable, and encourage those folks to, they're already doing the work, to share their best practices so we can disseminate them in a TRADOC Medco approved space and redistro those TSPs?
You hit on a lot of, I think, really important information there. You know, the democratization of information sort of runs counter to the sort of culture of InfoSec and OpSec that we have in the military.
No, you're spot on. I mean, this is part of the problem we've had. You know, I love everything that's going on with deployed medicine, the ability to share information and content, but there still is a security requirement. You know, those guys are working with retired Harold Montgomery and those great leaders over there. They're willing to put service specific landing pages so we can link to those protected documents or regulatory guidance for the service specific stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, that's a good way to go, because that content changes. We just change it on the landing page. We don't have to change the supporting documents. It just says go to, you know, deployedmedicine.army, for example, right?
And so, you know, along that vein, the older version of TC8-800 was behind the CAC wall and wasn't accessible because it did have some, you know, operational information in it. And this new version has been completely stripped of all of the individual tasks, you know, like you were talking about, Hunter, with making it more flexible as a document and allowing trainers to have more maneuverability as to how they conduct their training. So, Caleb, before we started recording, you were talking a little bit about spiral theory and getting reps in. And we touched on the idea of how Table 8, you know, as a condensed course-like checkbox training structure, led to a lot of annual sort of completion. And you use the analogy of the ACFT, where you wouldn't want to do PT for a week before you take your ACFT and expect to get a good score. And in the aviation community, I've often likened it to flying hours for pilots. You wouldn't want to fly in a Black Hawk with a pilot who got his entire annual flying hours in during the last week. You know, the guy would probably be upside down in the dirt in no time. And we don't want our medics to be upside down in the dirt. And so one of the things that you had mentioned was this idea of getting the reps in throughout the year. Now, I didn't see this specifically mentioned in the new TC8-800, but if you take a survey of all of the training doctrine throughout the Army, throughout all of the years, this concept sort of runs as a thread throughout everything we see. So, you know, I just want to give you guys an opportunity to talk about the importance of timing your training and frequency and again, dig into this spiral training theory a little bit.
So it's kind of the same thing we see on the, and with cognitive degradation, like when you apply like Ebbinghaus forgetting theories to the same thing happens with psychomotor skills. And so the thought process and you see that within the tasks. So when you look at the individual critical task list and look at those individual tasks, there's actually reps, how many times a year you're supposed to conduct so many reps. So those are built into each individual task, and those are determined. There's no real science behind it, but they're voted on that way by panel members that sit in a critical task site selection board. And so when you follow that methodology, it actually breaks that training up either into quarters, semi-annual, like it breaks it up over, this is how many times we think you should be doing this in order to maintain proficiency. It shouldn't be done in 2 weeks. So by moving to the ICTLs, that helps us address that issue, and it spreads that training out over time. So that was one of the reasons for removing those a lot of those pages out of there too. was so that it's like, hey, if you're following the ICTL, then you should be maintaining proficiency in that task. And then these things are all supposed to build on each other over time. Hopefully in the future, and when we get a better systems in place, what you'll see is like, okay, I've gained, like this person has mastered this task. I don't have to have him do it or her or she again for 2 years because they've got it. Like this, it's mastered. They're ready to move on and learn something new. So you replace something, you put something else in the bucket and you take it out. So that's hopefully where we go in the future. And this kind of helps set us up for that.
No, Hunter, that's great. I threw a link up. I don't know if you had a chance to look at it, but I encourage you and your listeners to look at the Government Accountability Office Report 21-TAC-337.
So that's the Defense Healthcare Actions Needed to Define and Sustain Wartime Medical Sales for Enlisted Personnel. Just rolls off the tongue.
No, it does. It does, right? And the Government Accountability Office, you know, that's the independent third-party assessor that, you know, national law says what the DOD is supposed to do. We say we're going to do it. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. And they come in and take a look at what we're doing and basically, is it working, right? So what they did with this one is they dug into all the enlisted medical force, which is about 70-some thousand folks across the services. I'm like, hey, how are we doing in that space, right? And this may be uncomfortable for some listeners, but they found out we're not doing real good. Our kung fu is weak. And they broke down some reasons and some methodology to address that. For those folks that are familiar with you know, Colonel Mabry's work, I think back in 2012, or any of the stuff, you know, recently by Dr. Cotwall, you know, a lot of this speaks to ownership. Who owns that pre-hospital medical space for the services? Yeah, not really anybody right now, right? So, but the Government Accountability Office report, you know, indicates that we have room for improvement. And just, again, breaking it down for knuckleheads like myself, you know, the 10,000 hour theory or, you know, what you habitually do is what you're good at. Well, what are our medics habitually doing right now? It's not a lot of pre-hospital medicine. And if it is, you know, let's be honest, like we talk a lot about trauma. That's the sexy stuff, right? But, you know, even for folks with multiple deployments and salty environments, that's really not a lot of what we do. It's prevention. It is planning. It's cross-loading. It is contingency. It is interface with our non-medical leaders to make sure that there are robust, you know, PACE plans or at least primary and alternate for evac. It's interfacing with, you know, if you're flying for me, that handshake before we do the mission is hugely important so that we know, you know, what's on the other end of that. You know, all that stuff is hugely important. And that's not happening in garrison. And you can trace things like that to the, you know, the death of the battalion aid station, et cetera. So now we have movements like the H2F, you know, holistic health movement of reinvigorating prevention and, you know, musculoskeletal, behavioral health, all that kind of stuff back at that unit level. Well, we've got to get on that train with our medics, right? Which means medical directorship. You know, as a medic, you can't have a scope of practice without a medical director. We do not have, outside the flight community, we don't have defined medical directors for pre-hospital space in the United States Army. That's a rate limiting step, right?
And there was a study that came out not too long ago that was looking at the familiarity that physician medical directors have with TCCC and their likelihood to allow their medics to practice TCCC, to carry the medications in the guidelines and things like that. And what the study found was, you know, a direct correlation between non-familiarity and non-compliance with TCCC and their medics. And so what would be your advice to medical leadership? So the E7, E8 medics that are, you know, sitting in your staff offices, your 04, 05 physicians and physician assistants who sort of did their time in the trenches and are now sort of in an administrative role. What is your advice to them when approaching this new version of TC8-800? How are they going to leverage the information in this document to make our ready medical force?
That's a great question. I think at this point, what we owe those folks out there that are laboring in the trenches, that are going to do the bulk of the bleeding and work for the next fight, is support and regulation. So in order for the TC to have teeth, it needs underpinning in Army or Joint regulation. You know, all the TC is right now is advice. So for those folks that are self-directed and motivated, you know, that right leading edge of the bell curve, they're already getting after it, right? They're already educating themselves. How do we shift for those folks that are the middle or on the trailing edge so that there's carrot and stick, right? There's incentive, there's career rewards for doing better training, or there's punishments and reflection on NCOR and more importantly, OER, I think, when there's not. So without regulation teeth, you know, I'm looking at 350-1, et cetera, what we're saying now is you should do better training, but there are few consequences if you don't, aside from, again, zipping up body bags when it goes sideways. So I think, you know, bottom up, yeah, get after it, guys. That's our job as NCOs. We are not on a bureaucratic timeline. We're on the enemy's timeline. If we go tonight, we're going with what we got. So get after it, right? Mm-hmm. For those that believe, get after it. You know, advocate, motivate, reach out, support each other. From the top down, though, really what we're looking at is at the Surgeon General level, let us hold Army medicine accountable for changing preventable death, what we currently define as KIAs in that pre-hospital space, hold ourselves accountable by choice and by regulation for quality assurance and quality improvement in that space. Currently, we only hold ourselves accountable for what we call died of wounds, which is after that patient touches a provider.
What do you think, Hunter?
Yeah. So from my side, just looking at it from the training aspect is being familiar with the TC3 guidelines and now the prolonged care guideline, prolonged casualty care guideline. There's some doctrine language there, some mix up between services and stuff, but as being familiar with those. And then also, and I mean, it's not just for medics. If you know, if you're a medical leader or in charge of a, you have a 68 Charlie LPN or what have you, is being familiar with their task list and actually reading them. So, and you'll see that in the new task for the medics. So we kind of built this in as I wouldn't want to call it a fail safe, but within those new ICTLs and those tasks that are the new references on all those are now CPGs, TC3 guidelines, and some of the prolonged care guidelines that we were already working with. So those, we've made a shift within writing the individual tasks. Where it used to be based off of old textbooks and stuff, PHTLS manuals, and now all the references have moved to CPGs and they model those. So all the new tasks that are dropping that slowly into the Central Army Registry right now are all built off from those guidelines and CPGs. So it was a big shift that we started last year. So it's being aware that is within the task and the. I don't want to say scope, but that is what the medic's supposed to be doing.
So to turn that question around, you know, and you have a young hard charging medic, you know, the kind of medic that listens to podcasts and reads the CPGs and that sort of thing. How would you recommend they take this rewrite of TC8-800 to their medical leadership, to their platoon sergeant or to their field surgeon or PA? What do you recommend for starting that conversation?
I think making them aware of those changes, and it's hard to see within the training circular itself that these changes are happening in the background because it's not written in there and it's intentional. But making them aware of those training requirements that you see in like paragraph 1-3 through I think it was 1-5 of those training requirements that those ICTLs are there. And I mean, anyone in the medical world right now is well aware of this ICTL thing and the leadership side. So once you step out into the maneuver realm, it gets a little tougher to explain that. But it's just being able to explain those training requirements to their leadership, saying this is what we have to do as medics to maintain our proficiency and do our jobs. There's another push to, which they already do it a little bit, but with our medical leader, like the leadership courses, captain careers course and battalion commander's course, like those types of courses, they're starting to talk about these things there in the medical world. So,
and you know, you referenced paragraph 1-3 in the new TC 8-800, and you know, 1-3 is talking about medical readiness training. So that DOD instruction that came out in 2018 that made TCCC the program of record. Mm-hmm. And it talks specifically about the Defense Health Agency, and you know, they're taking a leading role in distributing some of these educational materials, and it talks specifically about TCCC. And so this really is sort of a sea change pointing towards these reference documents like you're talking about. And yes. And that really seems important.
No, it is. So there was actually a link in there. It was removed during editing, but there was a link that took you to deployed medicine, and which I can go into the editing process and why things get removed once it hits certain levels. And if a reference isn't specific, but it is pointing to deployed medicine and that those TC3 training requirements and getting after like what Congress told us to do back in 17. So, but yeah, it's quite a shift, and it can be a little scary to a lot of leadership out there because it looks time consuming, but it, you know, we have to do these things. It's a training requirement. Mm-hmm.
So with that, you know, part of what we're accomplishing here too is trying to get efficiency. You know, there are a ton of training requirements out there, right? And depending on who you ask, the Army currently is somehow accomplishing more days of training than actually exist on the calendar. So, you know, hats off to everybody that's doing that. But specifically what we're trying to do with this is not add training, not add more days of training, but enable the existing required training to be of higher value, you know, mm-hmm. seeking it up. If I've got butts in seats, let's go ahead and make that worthwhile is what we're trying to get to.
So you're not trying to add, you're trying to optimize.
That's it. Yeah. If anything, mm-hmm. and that's really the challenge, you know, it's worth taking yourself down to your VFW or whatnot and talking to those folks that were active in the late 80s. You know, as we go into a period of fiscal and personnel restraints, the answer for no one is doing more. It is, especially for commanders, doing less, triage, right? Cut away the fluff. Let's get back to the basics. You know, some organizations called that the big four, the big five. Many leaders and general officers have some variant of that in their training guidance, but you will see very, very few commanders out there that either have the intestinal fortitude or are enabled by their hire to remove things from the training calendar. As we get back to getting good at war, that is the requirement. It's not do more. We're already doing more than we can. We're mediocre at a lot of stuff. Let's do less and be good at what's important.
That's great insight. And do you guys have any closing thoughts or sort of lingering points that you want to broadcast to the Army medical community? We have a lot of flight medic type listeners, but we also have a lot of ground guys that listen to our podcast. So any words of wisdom?
I think sharing out there that this is we're trying to get fire for a cultural evolution for Army medicine. Trying to re-engage what is Army pre-hospital medicine, which is also expeditionary medicine. And to achieve that, that's, you know, we're taking an organization that, if we're honest, is really optimized for homeostasis and trying to make it agile and adaptive. That doesn't happen overnight. Mommy and daddy aren't going to fix it for you. It's up to everybody that thinks it's important to start carrying some weight, shouldering the load, and more importantly, telling us where we're screwing up. You know, both Hunter and myself are, I think, pretty cognizant of our own limitations, right? We don't know everything. We don't know if what we're trying is working. We need that feedback from the force that we're trying to make changes for if we're on target or if we're fucked up. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like bring your A game and be self-aware.
Yeah. Team sport, guys.
Yeah. Earn it every day. Hunter, what do you think? What do you, what are your words of wisdom to the force?
I'd say, for, you know, like he said, is we got to keep on pushing. Everyone's got to remain agile. I mean, there's a lot of changes, not just to the medical, but just in the Army in general happening. And be prepared for stuff like that. And then when it comes to the document, like it's, the document's a little bit of ahead of a couple other things that, we're supposed to publish around the same time or before. So it just be on the lookout for those items to come. There's a brand new ICTL working, trying to get that finished up with the director of training doctrine down there. I talked to them last week about it. And then obviously the TC3 CMC combat medic to the tier 3. Hopefully that'll publish on deployed medicine soon. So, and there's also a new soldier training publication with the new task in there, pending publishing, or you'll see the, an old one, but then there's the 2021 task list that'll come right after it, and a new STP will follow. So the TC is a little bit ahead of a couple of items. So just be cognizant of that, but they are coming. Just to let everyone know.
Yeah. And with that, you know, kind of the last thing, yeah, we all need to go back and look at that 8-step training model, right?
Yeah.
It's an oldie, it's a goodie. And if you look at that, executing the course, that is the smallest part of what you do. It's the prep, and more importantly, the train, the trainers, that investment, which is what produces a good course. And then you're tightening your own shot group up. So for those that haven't seen the 8-step training model, or even if it's been a while since you looked at it, go back and look at it. You know, as we're in a time compressed environment, we cut away everything except for the execution. And I think that really affects the quality of our training.
Absolutely. And I'm going to put links to everything that we've discussed, all of the diagrams, the troop leading procedures, the ASEP training model, you know, all of this good, fundamental, super basic Army stuff that we learn in the beginning. You know, Caleb, you said towards the beginning it was for a long time a special operations mentality, and unfortunately seeing it more and more throughout the force. But brilliance in the basics is what makes you advanced. Mastering those simple tasks is really what enables you to be an ultra effective operator, whatever your job is. And so things like the TLPs and you know, reconning the site, your 8-step training model and you know, training the trainers, these are all super basic things that we need to be masters at. So that's fantastic. And Hunter, you were saying, you know, this sort of agile and flexible mindset that comes with being a practitioner of medicine, where we know that the right answer is always changing based on the science of medicine, and we learn something new every day and integrate it back into our practice. It sounds like those skills are going to help carry us forward as what we've been asking for a generation. Our medical doctrine is beginning to shift in a big way. And, you know, you guys are both key players in that. And I thank you very much. It's humbling for me to sit here and talk to you guys, making big changes in the organization that we all love. And so thank you for your time today, and thank you for your insight.
Well, Max, it was a real privilege, man. It's guys like you that are sharing the message and communicating that are making this. Again, you know, for nerds and introverts, it's tough to get this communicated out there to the force. So thank you so much for inviting us on.
Thanks for listening to the Dust Off Medic podcast. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to support the podcast, sharing it with others is the single best way you can do that. You can also follow us on social media and check out some of our previous episodes at dustoffmedicpodcast.com. If you use these podcasts for your training program, drop us a message and let us know what you're doing with it. If you have any ideas for the podcast or ways that we can add value to your training, let us know. We're always interested in new guests and new ideas for podcasts. So catch us next time on the Dust Off Medic podcast.